Hello and welcome to the Gambling Files. You're welcome. I'm your co-host, John Bruford, joined by my co-host, Fintan Costello. Hello, Fintan.
The only way to start this podcast today is, yo, VIP, let's kick it. Ice, baby. It's the Ice Baby episode. No? I thought it was funny. It was funnier in my head.
Yeah.
I'll stop.
No, it's good.
Collaborate and listen.
No. Oh, yeah, you're good. You probably weren't even born when that came out.
I sure was. I had dreams of parachute pants. Bit of ice, vanilla ice, MC Hammer. Can't touch this. Oof. Memories.
I would have been about 17, I think, when that came out. But I still loved it. Even though I was a rock kid, still loved it. It's a great tune. He has done multiple different versions, and Vanilla Ice has done a rock version of it.
I write my out of office when I go to ICE. I write it using the Ice Baby lyrics. So I've got this whole thing I do. That's quite popular. And then I'll end up getting emails from people because they've heard about the out of office from somebody else, and they're just sending me emails to get the out of office.
Nice. I've only set an out of office once. And it just said, if you need to get hold of me urgently, I suggest you go out into the street and walk around until you find somebody who is short, fat, and has very little hair, and speak to them.
Useful.
Well, I mean, I don't know if anybody actually did it, but it made me laugh. So, it is an icy. We have Alex Pratt from Clarion joins us for a conversation. And all credit to Alex. He answers all of our questions.
He did. And you didn't hold back?
No. It was it's because I've heard Alex on other podcasts and his colleague Stuart, and I didn't want to do a fluff interview. I didn't want to do an interview where we're just like, oh yeah, ice is going to be brilliant, isn't it? I don't know what's going on with your microphone there, Fintan. Sorry,
I'll stop. I was cleaning my laptop. That was me. Sorry.
I was just about to ask if you were playing with yourself, because we've had to talk about that before, haven't we?
We have. There was an intervention. Put it away, Fintan. Now is not the time.
It's not. There are families listening. Well, mine might be. My kids listen to. Oh, shit. I'm really swearing this, don't I? Kids, stop listening and go and tell mummy to turn the podcast off. Okay. Yeah. Go on, Al. Go and do it. Thank you. Good boy. Just in case. Alex was a very, very illuminating interview in which, of course, he confirms the venue change. Oh, the controversy. And we are then joined by Sean Chaffin. I made the mistake of calling him Sean Chaffin because it's got two Fs in it. And so if you're English, that's Chaffin. But he's from Texas, and you pronounce it Chaffin. Well, didn't I feel foolish?
You did.
I really did.
Rightly so as well. But Sean was lovely.
He was gracious about it. But Sean talks a little about the history of gambling in Texas, which is far, far more interesting than I would have put any money on. It's got an amazing history, but also talks a little bit about what's going on with the poker clubs in the state and the potential for casinos and where that might go, because that keeps coming up. And Sean is a freelance writer and editor working on multiple websites and magazines, and poker is very much a specialism of his. And busiest, so it's Texas, because he's from Texas.
Busiest man in Texas by his amount of jobs he has. It's amazing.
Well, that's the world. That's the world of freelance, Fintan. We can't all, fanny about building up a business, then sell it.
Okay. All right.
Was that sufficiently damning?
I'm sorry.
I love the idea that you've been fannying about building up a business. I think it's hilarious.
Lots of other people all the way.
Swanning into your office, working for 16 hours a day. How dare you?
Living the dream. The dream.
Not like people like me who work 9 to 5, slaving our guts out. Oh, no, hang on. I've never worked 9 to 5, actually. Oh, well. That's the episode today, which is quite exciting. Fintan has a bit of a cold, but he struggles manfully through, and the end result is pure listening gold.
So, word to your mother. Let's do it.
Word to your mother, indeed. Enjoy the episode, and that's it, really. Word to your mother. We go to our first guest of this episode, and we're very privileged, like every other podcast in the industry, to be joined by one of Clarion's top table, one of their A team. I don't know if he's Hannibal or BA or, you know, one of the others, but we're delighted to be joined by Alex Pratt, Managing Director at Clarion Gaming. Alex, welcome.
Thank you. I think I like to always thought of myself as face, but I'm not sure I really have achieved it.
I think we'd all like to think of ourselves as face, but in reality, most of us are a little bit of Murdoch and a bit of George Peppard's ass. But I don't know, Fintan, if you were in the A team, who would you be, do you think?
I think I'm a Hannibal.
Yeah.
I'm going to throw it out there.
I think with your recent track record of being an extremely successful and important businessman, you can claim that. The bonus points to anybody that remembers Face's real name in the show.
Steve? I mean, that is a guess.
I mean, it's a solid guess, but no. I think it was Templeton Peck.
Really? Wow.
Which is a fantastic name. Almost as good as the actor that played him, who was, of course, Dirk Benedict.
There was a great quote from an interview with Mr. T about his name.
Yeah.
And so he grew up in segregated America, and he changed his name to Mr. T to force people to call him Mr. And so he's got a whole kind of really, really interesting backstory.
Top man.
To why he chose his name, and it's a brilliant interview.
Are you familiar with the book A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius by Dave Eggers, which is a great name for a book, let's be fair?
No.
There's a chapter in that about Mr. T, because it's about this, it's a memoir, and Eggers raised his younger brother after their parents died, and it's a beautifully written book. It's a really, really good read. But there's just this chapter in it about Mr. T moving in somewhere near where they lived. it's brilliant. And whenever I think of Mr. T, I think of A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, and what a brilliant name it is for a book. Like if I write a horror book, I'm going to call it "This Book Is So Scary You'll Shit Your Pants." Just like, you know, so I'm front loading it. I'm saying this is what you're getting. We digress slightly. So Alex is here to talk about ice, which is, you know, it's a tricky one.
Yes, there's a lot going on.
There's a lot going on. And we're gonna delve into that. We're going to be like a vet in a cow's bum. We're going to get up to the elbows in ice. Alex, who's going to ice?
Oh, what a big question.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. And it's an interesting one, because what are we, about eight, nine weeks out, I think, now. And if I'm looking more at now how the registration's changed, I guess, from pre-January to now, pre-January, the technical term, it was going nuts. It was taking us by surprise, because we always felt that during COVID, with events, et cetera, people have different priorities. You tend to see a lot more has senior people going to the shows and taking less teams, so you expect less people to come. But yeah, pre-Omicron, we were seeing the reverse. We were seeing big volumes, still those decision makers, but big volumes, which wasn't the normal pattern of our events. We obviously then moved the event and naturally expect the attendance to be less, I think, because A, it's the week before Easter, B, there's school holidays, C, some of our bigger exhibitors are now not exhibiting, and those guys would bring teams sometimes of up to sort of 500 and in cases sort of 600-700 people. But anyway, I digress. What are we seeing? I am seeing still, I suspect, about 80% of the normal attendance in terms of volume. The last 2 weeks, we're seeing data reflecting the same registration patterns as February 2020. In terms of what makes up that those attendees, it will be more people from the but looking for online solutions as opposed to land-based solutions. I've seen a drop off. If you look at the tick boxes, do you work in land-based, online, or both? We've seen a drop off of about 4.5% to about 9% of attendees now are pure land-based, and that's that kind of 4.5% is equally been added on to the guys that are coming from an online perspective or coming from an omni-channel perspective. So, yeah, look, naturally you're going to see less land-based people there, but you're not going to see none of them, or certainly that's what we're finding. We were out with the ECA yesterday and they said that their management teams are still going, but they're less likely to send big teams of slot technicians because the slots aren't going to be on the show floor in order for them to look at, which, you know, is, I guess, what you'd expect.
I'm going to be there.
Good. The funny thing is everyone I speak to from an attendee perspective is saying, I'm going to be there. Is it definitely happening? And I get a lot of messages saying, look, I'm about to spend X amount of money on travel. Is it definitely happening? And from an attendee perspective, I think everyone wants to still go for multiple reasons. Some of it's just actually we haven't had an event. We haven't had ice for a couple of years, and I guess it was the meeting place. And then actually a lot of people need to do business. So, yeah, it's slightly, I don't know, it's slightly ironic sometimes where we've got attendees really wanting to come and some exhibitors not wanting to.
I heard a rumour that Fintan is going to be there and that he's going to be riding a golden Segway.
Wow.
I told you not to talk about that, Joe.
I will need to get some sort of health and safety on that segue there, unfortunately, Fintan. It's
it doesn't apply when you reach a certain level of business.
You gotta catch me first. You gotta catch me.
He's gonna take the speed limiter off it.
His own carpet will be laid that only Fintan can use. Also in gold.
See, this can work. You know, I mean, 80%, I see that I'm hearing a lot of conflicting things from people that I'm talking to.
Yeah.
And, you know, a lot of operators and the ones that do return my calls and emails, you know, obviously not that many of them, but some people are really bullish about it and some people are meh, you know. It's like, I know everybody wants it to happen.
Yeah.
But it's the relevance to the different sectors that's the key, isn't it? And as you pointed out, you know, there's this kind of, it's like a basking shark in a way, or even a hammerhead, or possibly a thermal vent in the ocean. The central pillar supports a lot more things than just itself. So once you take a couple of the big slot companies out of it, and I think most of them aren't coming. I think most of them have said they're going to defer to next year. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that means that, you know, you get the sort of ancillary services to the land-based sector, like, seating, I guess even like, slot bits and bobs, you know, toppers, all that kind of stuff. They're not going to see the foot traffic without the people that are there for the slots. And also sometimes exhibitors are there for the other exhibitors to come and see them.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess that's a part of why some of these companies have been dropping out, because they're not. And it's not that the foot traffic isn't going to be there; it's that it's not going to be the right foot traffic for them.
Yeah, look, and I think we have to. We'd be absolute idiots if we weren't going to admit that it's going to be a different version of ICE that we've seen in the past. And I think I often reference or look back at CES and what they went through in January, and the guy that came out, or the guy that runs it, and he talked about CES being a different type of event without those tier ones at the show. And even that's different, because actually those tier ones weren't coming. I think a lot of these tier one suppliers are still attending, but not necessarily with product. So it does mean there is a chunk of attendance that won't be at that show this year. Am I gutted about that? Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a real shame, because I really wanted the industry to come back together at ICE, and I've been waiting 2.5 years to see that. Do I think, and my big worry, I guess, is that are we listening to the market? And are we putting this event on because of the right reasons? And I guess the right reasons are, is it because the market wants it? And we are constantly researching, surveying, having conversations, following data, anecdotes, anything to just make sure that we're doing it for the right reasons. And I think, yes, it means someone that's coming to buy slots is probably not going to come this year. But someone that's looking at the opportunity in iGaming or sports betting is gonna come to the event. Or it isn't just about buying. Some of it's around actually just networking with your peers. And what we've spoken to some operators is actually they're using that time to have more meeting. And this sounds like totally straight out of a event marketer's playbook. It's genuinely the truth.
I couldn't possibly comment.
This is what they tell us. They tell us that actually, look, and they do. Like I found it, I met someone the other day, I told me the night before, the Sunday night of ICE, there used to be about 12 CEOs that used to meet of all places in Barcelona before they flew into London. And that's the biggest value they get from the whole show. It's a different need. So
does that mean that the show's not very good then?
I think
Barcelona pre-meetup's better. I'm just throwing it out there.
No,
it wasn't me who said it.
I agree. I think the role of a show is it offers all sorts of different things. And I think what it does is give an anchor or point in a date in a city that allows people to meet. If so happens that they don't meet within the show and a small proportion don't, I still think that's brilliant, because the brand's bringing people together. And I guess that's our role. I used to, like, before we sold to Clarion, we'd have all sorts of different companies putting events on and around our affiliate events that we used to run. And I just felt that was a good thing, because it brought people to town. If it meant 90% of the people that they brought came to our show, it helped. Maybe we lost 10%, but I don't think you can ever really own an entire monopoly on a city. Yeah, I was going to say, another data point is on these polls on LinkedIn that everyone seems to have one running in every shape or form these days. But one that kind of became fashionable, I guess, the last month or so was, are you going to ICE? Look, and this is not the definitive science of all science, but every data point is a data point. And actually, they all tend to come up around the same data that we're polling from our customers, which is about 76% combined. So usually it's around 50-55%. Yes, I am going, and around 20% I haven't decided yet. So for me, look, it is a finger in the air, and it is really hard. With an event, normally it's hard to predict any kind of attendance. In COVID, I'd say the only thing we've learned in the last 12 months is you have no idea if your event will be successful till probably 48 hours before, but you kind of follow a number of different data points to understand who's going to be attending and have they booked their hotels, and we can look at all these things. So, yeah, I think the long-winded answer, I think, was are people going or how many do we expect, is, yeah, I think it will be a very different type of audience. I think you'll get the senior management teams from the land-based side, not necessarily the big 40, 50 people they'll bring, maybe 5 or 10. And then I think you'll find a lot of people from the online and iGaming sports betting sector. The other thing is the world's changing really fast. I think when we first postponed this, people felt that one of the big kind of threats even for April was going to be COVID. And if you look at, I guess, how we were 2 weeks ago in the UK, or even in some of the other European countries, to where we are now, it's hugely different. And look, we've just been announced that all restrictions are going. By mid-March, I feel it's going to feel very normal across Europe. And money will start to flow through some of these land-based guys' operators. Look, very initial stages, but they're going to start to have that need to buy. It's going to start to feel a bit different. And guess what? There's an event in 4 weeks' time. I'm not saying come on for the whole week. You may have other plans, but it's not hard to fly in Europe to somewhere on a Tuesday, Monday, stay for a day or two, and then fly out. And I just think that the decision is going to remain right to that last minute.
See, you say that it's not difficult to fly somewhere in Europe, but that does bring up one of the other thorny issues around ICE.
Yeah.
Because actually it is more difficult now if you are flying from another European country or if you are flying from one of the 27 European Union states. It is different now. And I mean, that's I know nobody has necessarily cited that as a factor in their decisions in withdrawal. But it must have been, I mean, with COVID and Brexit, it's the perfect shitstorm, really. So, you know, It's not as simple as, you know, when we had Schengen policy at our borders. You can literally stick your passport in your pocket and walk on a plane and walk off the other side. Can't do that anymore.
I haven't found that to be a big hurdle or that vastly different from an attendee or tourist perspective. Certainly when we ran a very large international event back in October, not in the gaming market. I think if someone needs to go somewhere for work and I'm not finding that as anything coming back in any kind of our research or whether it's focus groups or surveys that.
But if a company's bringing 500 people, then it is going to be a part of their thinking. Because if all of those people need a visa to get into the UK, simply as an investment in time, and therefore an as investment in money.
Visa, though, if you're coming from Europe, I don't know.
That's what I'm asking you. I mean,
I assume that you must know. No, as far as I understand, you don't need a visa whatsoever. And we've looked at this for a few other guys who are like, oh, if we're working a stand, do we need a work visa? No, it makes absolutely no difference. You're traveling as you would have been as an attendee, as you would have been before.
Is that going to be how that works going forward, or is that like just in a transition period kind of malarkey?
From an attendee, we've heard it will be, that's how it works going forward. And we ran obviously a couple of international shows, and that was a concern from, particularly from our exhibitors. And this isn't, obviously there's some admin and additional costs around bringing goods into the UK. But from an attendee perspective, it's like a minor level of annoyance, if anything. I guess like when I travel in now, we have to go in a different queue and it's annoying if it's longer. But I think it stretches to about that. But certainly you don't need work visas or anything like that if you're coming from Europe. Same as like if you look at the US guys when they used to come over to run their stands and their show, they didn't have to get specific visas for working on a stand as such.
Is it the case that is say I was some kind of hardware supplier based in an EU state? Do I have to import my stuff and then export it again? Is that true? Because I did hear that. Yeah. Is that right?
Now, for this particular question, we have two really big, huge shipping companies that work with all our exhibitors, not just at this show, other shows, but on the technicalities of import, export, and Brexit rules, and if you're and it all comes down to specifics around if you're leaving the goods in the UK, that's different from bringing goods in for exhibiting. And I would not be able to. If I could, I would also be joining the Human Cloud as a import-export advisor. But we would normally work with each customer on a case by case basis. We know that it will cost more because of Brexit, and there will be admin. What we don't know, because we haven't run a gaming show during Brexit, is what that impact is. We think it's around, talking to our suppliers, around 7 to 10%, depending on what they're bringing in and how they're bringing it in, et cetera, et cetera. The annoyance, I guess, the other increase that we're seeing is coming from supply chain, logistics, staff issues, all the things that we're seeing as a, I guess, a global impact or knock-on effect from COVID, which would be whether you have Brexit, whether it's in Europe, UK, wherever. It's just, unfortunately, things are more expensive.
In terms of Excel, I mean, it is, and you, I'm sure you're going to be able to correct me here. Is Excel 8 halls? It's 4 halls either side.
I believe it's 17 halls either side that they break down into.
They must have some at the back that I haven't seen yet. But does ICE in a standard year use all of Excel?
We do, although we use a big chunk for storage. And then obviously we've got the affiliate event at the end.
Well, so I would think with that amount of people, you probably need most of that just for their coats.
I mean, the storage is like, if you imagine, I can't remember which edition of Indiana Jones, when he goes into that storage place. And I think
it's Raiders of the Lost Arks right at the end.
And it's like that inside some of the halls towards the end. It's absolutely nuts, and it's probably not so interesting to everyone, but it's a logistics nightmare of where you can store all that product that needs to be both put on a stand, but also regularly walk back and forth, like all the sausages on a stand or the drinks and all those sorts of things.
Okay, but in terms of where ICE is at today, is it going to be filling the same space as before?
No. No, and you should, and because we're updating that floor plan quite often, if you go to the ICE site, you can see the layout. But if you think, it's 18 halls either side. So normally we'd take up both sides up to hall 18 on north and south. This year, right now, we are up to hall 18 on the north, and we're up to hall 12 on the south. So we've lost about 6 halls on the south side, and that's through, I guess, and you'll see like that's without, I mean, that's with a handful of empty stands that aren't significantly big. So we haven't lost a huge amount. We've had quite a few people upsizing, not just off the back of some availability where they've been able to get into spaces that weren't available before, but over the last 12 to 18 months, people have chosen to invest more in the show. And then we've also invested more around some of the features. So that we want to, for example, we're building out a feature for the land-based market. So it gives them a place to meet at a home. What we don't want to do, we recognize that there's going to be a lot of iGaming exhibitors at the show, but actually we still need to build out a place and a position for those land-based attendees to know where to meet, where maybe previously they met on the Galsman stand or on the Novomatic stand or wherever else.
Yeah, the big, I say the big rumour, a big, big-ish rumour is that, do you know what? I'm not even going to tell you what the rumour is.
Oh, another rumour.
Yeah, but I don't want you to feel bad about yourself. I will get to it, but obviously, I don't know how to put this really. Some exhibitors have expressed some displeasure with aspects of ICE over the years.
Yeah.
That comes with organising any event, and I totally get that. But it's fair to say, and I am not dissing the British casino industry when I say this by any stretch, but the British casino industry is a relatively small part of the European casino industry.
Yeah.
Particularly in terms of slots. I don't think anybody can possibly deny that with the rules the way they are at the moment, although the rumour is that the slot designation is going to go up in the gambling review. We will see. Now, with Brexit, with Europe being Europe, it would make sense logistically to me to move ICE to a mainland European country.
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to do that?
I'm not a politician, but I would say maybe.
Just go for yes or no then.
I'd say maybe. And I'll tell you the reason is that, I've been going to ICE for 18 years now. And
I've never bumped into you there. I'm not sure that's true.
I'm quite sure. And it's also so crowded because it's the number one event in the world, you know. It's very hard to bump into people. It's all about organising.
Yeah. But I would have thought once in 18 years, you know what I mean?
I believe, and Kate said this before, I believe we're kind of custodians for the brand, in that we don't really own this event. Yeah, we do on paper, but actually without the support of the market, whether it's the suppliers or the operators, we don't have an event. So for me, if it needs to be in Europe, I'm not neither here nor there. We would actually make more money with it being in Europe. Logistically, it would potentially be easier depending on the venue. What I have to get right is make sure that move is what the market wants. So last year, when we took on ICE, we started to listen, and I think this was a lot of events out there that ran these giant events. You got to a point where you were running a monopoly. And when I say a monopoly, I mean a monopoly almost in on a time and a date that people were, we have to be at ICE because it's the biggest. And if you're not there, what? And actually, how can you run a business that's almost fundamentally blackmailing your customers to be in? So we started to ask them, what do they think of ICE? And look, one of the things that became really apparent is people are spending millions and millions and millions and millions on this show. And we hadn't taken account for that spend beyond our own. So we were really proud that we charge less than X and we haven't put our prices up, et cetera, et cetera. What we hadn't done is actually held our suppliers and our city to a degree to the same account. So the first thing we did is, that all came out in the press. It took about 6 months and we brought down costs down across the board and have frozen those for years. The next thing, because a big part of that was London. London's expensive. The fact is, if you move this event to Madrid, Amsterdam, Barcelona, wherever it is, and we have large events in those cities, your hotel costs will naturally, by basic economic theory, go up, and it will still be an expensive show to attend, no matter where you host it. But I get there's other ways that you can get advantages. Anyway, really long-winded answer. So the first thing we did is speak to the buyers, the operators, and through that research, at least last year, 3/4 of them told us that they'd like to keep it in London. The next piece of work we're doing now, and actually kicking off right now, is on the exhibitor side, because I get they're a massive part of the market. So we're doing a qualitative survey with external researchers, with kind of the top 50 exhibitors, and we'll dissect that by what market they're from, what footprint they have, et cetera, et cetera. And then a quantitative survey. I'd like to, if it comes out that we need to move this show to Europe because of any of those reasons, then we will move it 100%. And if that means that we are financially impacted, that's fine, because in the long term, it will all add up. But what I don't want to do is move a show that hasn't run for 2 years, 2.5 years, hasn't run during Brexit, actually fundamentally was working really well in terms of the results it was delivering. And I guess for people to understand, if it moves to Europe, it isn't the same. Excel was a really unique venue, and we won't get into the nuances of exhibition management, but like, for example, if you put it in the Rye, you'd have to decrease the size of the show by 20% immediately, and you'd have a user journey that you wouldn't want to explain. You couldn't build high in many of the rooms. You'd have logistical difficulties. So it's not as simple as going, I really like this city, has great flights in, let's put it here. There will be a knock-on effect that the market has to understand that's what will come with that move. With the
I get that, but, and there's no getting around this,
mm-hmm.
Right? So the first time I ever went to Excel was for the London Marathon Expo.
Yeah.
And that expo's got like 60 odd thousand people going in and out over what, 3-4 days?
Mm-hmm.
It's a pain in the ass. And Excel is a terrific venue.
Yeah.
Really, really excellent. Like the way that the concourse is set out, the number of food outlets, the number of toilets, all the basics, really good. One of the best I've been to. Location, big bag of shite.
Yeah.
And there's no getting around that. And the hotels in the immediate area, it's like you say that, like, if you go to Madrid or Amsterdam, people are going to pay more for their hotels. I don't think they're going to be paying more than they pay for the hotels that are right around the XL. That's hideous. That is absolute gouging.
Yeah, I guess the good news on that is that we've brought all those hotels together, and because everyone are pre-booked and rolling over hotel rooms, it couldn't happen for 22. But for 23, they, as part of an agreement with us, they can't go more than, I think it's £30 more than the same version of their hotel in central London. Part of that is because obviously the Crossrail that's coming in is going to change the entire dynamic of that show. So suddenly, and we bang on about it all the time, but suddenly it's 40 minutes to Heathrow direct, 43, 12 or 13 minutes straight to Bond Street. And it will change. Look, the location's not going to change. What will change is whether people need to stay in that campus, or actually do we build a separate campus in central London because it's a 10 minutes really quick or 13 minute really quick train ride. But yeah, there's no getting around the fact that it is not in an ideal location with regards to London. You'll find that with a lot of other venues around Europe, but yeah, some are in brilliant locations. And I guess that's one aspect we'd be looking at and getting that feedback from exhibitors and attendees.
But for me, there's one standout location in Europe that's big enough.
Yeah.
But, you know, I'm no event organizer. I mean, I have organized some events, but they're not international gaming shows.
Yeah.
Which is probably slightly different to what I organized a wedding fair once. True story.
Not doing COVID.
Huge success, actually. Roaring success. So successful, in fact, that somebody was there from another wedding fair and they stole the book of contacts that people signed when they walked in. Absolute wankers. I do have more questions, so just bear with me.
I want to know where your ideal venue is.
I'd say Messe München.
Is that Munich?
Yeah.
No, and the German Messes can handle ice.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, the one at Friedrichshafen, maybe, and beautiful place, pain in the ass to get to. But yeah, the Messe München is like, it's big enough. It's definitely big enough. Yeah. And a great city. It would mean a slightly different format to the show because you haven't got one big wide open hall, as I recall. You've got a bunch of smaller halls, but it's set up to be easy for people to get around. And yeah, I've had some great experiences there. That's the standout in my head.
Yeah. Oh, look, my mind is open. If it comes back and we need to run this event, if it comes back that actually, look, it doesn't work, Brexit really has had a much bigger impact than people think, London is still really expensive, people could get better value, better ROI from a European event, then we will immediately look at all the options and present that back to the market of what that means.
And I'd be willing to bet that Novomatic and Mercury will vote for Munich.
Yeah. Well,
but I mean, I might be wrong.
I don't know. Interestingly, talking to some of the German suppliers, they don't want it in Germany because it gives, and it sounds slightly ironic, but gives them an unfair advantage over their competitors. And I guess they see the role of ICE as being that European show that brings everyone together, and they don't want, I think they want, I get a level of harmony.
Well, why don't you go the whole hog then and have it in a country where gambling's banned? Let's have it in the UAE. Fucking, let's have it in Dubai. No, let's Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, just hope we can get everyone back home after.
It'll be fine. What could possibly go wrong? And to all our Saudi listeners, I think we have got a Saudi listener, Fintan.
We do.
To all of our Saudi listener, we'll see you soon. So what's the effect of all of this and that changing the way the exhibitors are changing this year and all of that jazz? What's the effect of that on the conference program?
Not a huge effect, to be honest, because we've still got I think I mentioned this earlier. I was meeting with the ICC. ICC. I was meeting with the ECA yesterday to talk about
the cricket people. The ICC.
talk about the comms we obviously run in partnership with them, as well as iSpox, and their members are still looking to attend, as far as through their own research and conversations. So it won't have a huge impact. The one thing we're doing differently this year is this kind of masterclass approach. So we can actually, in real time, and it's always going to be the plan, just see which ones are being bought, which ones aren't, and be able to almost react more, react off the back of that data and can some of them, and so you don't end up with that embarrassingly six people in a room and not offering much value.
I've seen way worse than that. I was at the Macau gaming show, and I saw people come out of the conference talks, staff members of the, you know, belonging to the organizers, trying to press gang people into going in. They were trying to drag people into the, because there was nobody in there.
Yeah.
But you know, that was a hideous event. Every time I've been, I think it can't be this bad. Next time, surely. And then you go the next time and it's even worse. But I'm not dissing it at all. I'm totally dissing it. It was horrible. So we've talked a bit about, you know, moving it to Germany, which you're totally on board about. We've talked about Brexit, which apparently have no effect. Crossrail. That's an interesting one, because Crossrail is something I haven't thought about because I don't live in London and I don't care. But now I do care because it affects my beloved ICE. Alex, you mentioned Crossrail earlier and how that's going to improve transport links into the Docklands area. Can you tell us a little bit about Crossrail and why it's such a hot potato?
In my non-train expert voice, what I can tell you is that it is a new train line. It's been in typical UK engineering, or anything government funded.
It will be dead by the time it's finished.
It's way too late, but it is at last like a learn. They've been running it on test now since October, I think. They're in the last final stage of testing now, which I believe is all around escape. Can people escape in time, etc., etc. Emergency drills and things like this. So, if we were to have any luck, which we haven't had very much of in the last couple of years, it may be open in time for ICE this year. It will be definitely open in time for ICE in 2023. But it just changes what Excel is and that location in the middle of nowhere, because suddenly actually you can wake up in Bond Street, and I believe the time is around 15 minutes. You can get on the Crossrail at Bond Street and be at Excel in 15 minutes, and it's brand new trains, really fast. They can take tens of thousands of people an hour, and it's something that Excel has needed for years, because as you say, like, it's stuck out in the middle of nowhere. It doesn't really have a connection to London. I think a lot of people do stay on the Excel campus a lot of people stay on the Excel campus because they like to wake up, roll out of bed and jump in. But a ton of others actually would put up with that 10-minute train ride. And it changes, I think, the logistical nature or nightmare, let's call it, of Excel.
I know that could be absolutely huge. And I'm not joking, because it will mean that people don't necessarily have to be gouged. I appreciate what you're saying about the £30 a night thing, but you know, if you can stay in, I don't know, some shithole in the back end of Beyond and still be there in 45 minutes, why wouldn't you?
45 minutes is Heathrow, so you can stay all the way out in Heathrow if you like and be there in 45 minutes.
Well, yeah, and there's a lot of shitholes around Heathrow. I've stayed in half of them at least. I'm not dissing them.
I think the interesting thing that I didn't realise, that when they moved Excel to from Earls Court to Excel, they obviously ran. There was a huge amount of opposition that we all loved Earls Court, and there's a huge amount of marketing done to get people to attend Excel. I guess it's really logical when you look back now, is the people that are coming from outside of London are going to come to Excel, whatever, because they've got on a plane, they've got a hotel, and so they will turn up at Excel, even though it is in not the most ideal location. The target market that doesn't turn up is those Londoners, and it's they wake up and actually they're, oh God, can I really be bothered to traipse across London to Excel today? And I think that's the Crossrail will really help relocate a lot of those people that are going to fly in anyway and just give them a much better experience. But for me, it also makes those local, and there is a vast amount of people that attend from London and the home counties, it actually makes it much easier for them to attend as well.
Yeah, right. Fair enough. Let you have that one. Now, here's my most difficult question. Are you ready?
Yeah.
Kate Chambers, who I think you probably know.
I am aware of Kate.
What happened there? So Kate was no longer working with Clarion. And then Kate was brought on board with her new company to work with Clarion on ICE. Speaking as an outsider, that looked for all the world like, let's get rid of ICE royalty because of some reason, and oh shit, we made a mistake, quick, get her back. I'm happy to be corrected, but what happened?
To a degree, that is, you know, in really raw form, marginally true. And you could have asked a more difficult question, by the way. And I think, look, what happened, I guess taking a step back, we are an events business and we make money by putting an events on. And during COVID, we haven't been able to put events on, so we don't have cash coming in. So like many of those businesses, yeah, we had to look at how to save costs. And part of that was around staff. And look, it's really harsh and upsetting and an emotional thing. I'm sure many people that listen to you went through this as well. But yeah, part of that is that Kate left Clarion Gaming. We then talked, we were actually talking in the background for a good 3 or 4 months around trying to retain Kate as a consultant. Because look, she knows the market, she has relations in the market. She actually, at her core, she loves ICE beyond anything else. She absolutely loves ICE and wants it to do well. Which is why I think it just makes her so good at what she does. We couldn't get to a deal. She was also exploring her own stuff, and I'm not going to, I think actually she's talked about it to Lewis Beck on G3, and she's exploring a digital product that hopefully will come to market in the next few months, which you can talk to her about. But so she's exploring some options around there, and it took about 6 months to get a deal done that would work for her, less so for us. I think we always wanted to retain her in some shape or form. So I wouldn't say we made a mistake and suddenly realized we needed her. I think it just took a long time to negotiate a deal that she wanted to engage on. And I think the real motivator is she loves ICE. And look, she's been brilliant now. I work with her, obviously, quite closely. She knows especially the land-based market and the nuances and what's going on there and what people are saying and as you say, rumours, and helps me to make some decisions, I guess, better, more informed decisions at times.
Fintan, do you know Lewis from G3?
I don't know Lewis.
Really?
Yeah.
You He's should. Really nice well, guy. I mean, they're a nice bunch, G3. I'm a big fan. And, well, I mean, we get on with almost all of the magazines. But I was just thinking, like, because they do their podcast on video.
Yes.
And I was thinking, maybe he's just better looking than me. But then I thought, if I wanted resolution on that particular topic, there's a LinkedIn poll waiting to happen. Who's better looking, me or Lewis?
Wow, do it.
I'm going to have to put an up-to-date photo on there.
If we could even build a kind of entrance feature with a happy or not button, and we could just reprogram that to who's better looking. I feel like this will be the thing that really brings the crowds to ICE, if we can put something like that in there.
Well, also, if it culminated in maybe a Speedo wearing jelly wrestling battle to decide who the handsomest editor is. I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there. It's not something I've thought about in my dreams ever. So anyway, what would have been the most difficult question I could have asked Alex? Because I might ask it. What would that be?
I don't know. I think it's just, as I said this to you earlier, my philosophy is just be as honest and transparent as possible. I think it just, and I think none of them would be that difficult. But I think the amount of rumors I hear of things that I'm up to or that we're up to as a business, I think it's just dealing with some of those questions. But yeah, I don't know. Let's wait and see. I don't know. I'll email you it.
Well, I was waiting for you to say something like, well, you know, we're doing this for the industry, because I'd have jumped straight on that. But you didn't say it. So I'm gutted.
We are, though.
Oh, you had to go there, didn't you? You had to go there. Who owns Clarion?
Blackstone.
Blackstone? What do they do? Are they some kind of philanthropic group?
Yeah, I mean, actually, to be fair, the one advantage we do have, and I think I've said this a few times, is that Blackstone does give us the freedom to be able to make decisions, and I know you're going to hate this, to be able to do stuff for the industry. And that event we ran, we run a fairly large show that runs biannually back in October, similar size to ICE, actually, XL. And it would have been better for us to have cancelled that, or postponed it, is the buzzword, for another year, because we couldn't get the international exhibitors in because of COVID at the time, et cetera, et cetera. So it became a very UK show, which meant we lost money compared to actually just postponing it, because we could have done that under a force majeure. And we can do that because we have the backing of people like Blackstone, because obviously they see value in the long-term business. And actually, we don't need to necessarily deliver a profit for this year that some of the PLCs do. They have to cut costs or have to put an event out that actually people don't want. And that's my biggest pain point, is I just want to make sure that we are not doing this for the wrong reasons.
But, you know, like, I forget what the medical product is, but there is a medical product that is quite important, and it requires an enzyme produced in the livers of bears, right?
Yeah.
And these bears have a, frankly, horrendous life, and they are kept alive so this enzyme can be harvested from their livers, right?
Yeah.
That is not being done for the bears.
No.
It's being done for the shit off their livers, so that the company that, in big inverted commas, owns the bears can do what it does. So the only issue I have with the for the industry thing is that it's actually it's keeping the show alive and doing it for the industry, big inverted commas, is actually just to keep a profitable show going, to make a profit for a venture capital type company.
Yeah. I suppose if you extrapolate it, you could say we are doing it for the industry because we know that if we do it, we'll be able to have a more valuable business in 3 years' time that will then make more money for the owner, you could say.
Well, I mean, I'm trying to think of a comparable animal.
As soon as you stop doing it, it is a buzzy buzzword, but there's a watch fair in Basel that's tens of years old, and it died because they stopped listening to the market. And there's a whole bunch of events that have died in the last 3 years, either because they held on to people's money, or they didn't roll it over, or they didn't listen to the market, or the value that they were delivering wasn't right. And actually, and that's my biggest, it's always my biggest worry, is that we have to do what's right by the customer. And it might sound a bit straight out of management textbook, but as soon as you stop, you become, I guess you become invalid in the market.
I wonder how many people at that watch fair would go around asking people for the time. A friend of mine used to do that. When I was living in London, I had a flatmate. She was from Ludlow as well. And she, her favourite thing to do was to walk around near Big Ben and ask people if they got the time. And it's
very
like...
Very Dom Jolly.
You can take the... This was pre-Dom Jolly. This is decades ago. But you can take the woman out of Ludlow, but you can't take Ludlow out of the woman. you know. Fintan, have you got any particularly salient questions? I should explain to listeners that Fintan has a bit of a cold. She's got a bit of a sniffle and he's feeling a bit poorly.
I think you've covered everything. Sorry, I'm just going to talk. Alex, what about competition? So there's a lot more events, or it seems to be a lot more events happening in general in space. Other organizers seem to be really upping their game. The iGaming Next guys, for example. How do you view that? Like, what does the landscape look like to you?
Yeah, and are you going to crush them?
No, we're all one big friendly family. There is a ton of events, and to be honest, before I took over Clarion, Clara was responsible for about 60% of them, including all the virtual ones we were pumping out. I feel like there's always been a high volume of events in the gaming market, and there probably always will be until the point where people stop spending money on exhibiting at them. As for upping our game and looking at it depends which sector. I think what iGaming Next is doing is brilliant. Like, they found a niche, or a niche, if for their New York event around that investment community. And it's something actually we've done in the past. And I think if we can support them and work together with them, that's brilliant. Same with SBC. Look, they really focused in on the sports betting market, and they've been able to leverage that. I'm less bothered about competition, to be honest. I think there's enough pie. I think we all occupy different areas. Look, with something like ICE, it's going for scale, ROI on over 3 days for people that come there. It's also covering that land-based sector in Europe at a pan-European level, which there isn't really any competitors at the moment for. We then have our affiliate shows, which fundamentally don't have competitors, even though all these shows have affiliate aspects to them. I don't feel that. And then we have IGB Live, which is a burgeoning, that's not the right word, John, you're clever of words, but
burgeoning.
Thank you, burgeoning. Even though we launched it about 14 years ago or something, I feel like it's just starting to come into its own. And had such a successful event in October that, despite getting it off the week before, Holland actually reduced their allowing us to fly into the Netherlands. So look, and what I'm trying not to do is to just launch tons and tons and tons of events for the sake of it. And I think we'll focus on those three areas, and we might expand into some other markets, but we'll do it quite carefully. And if there's incumbents there, I'm not into world domination anymore. I've changed. COVID's changed me. I'm more into actually what we deliver better in terms of the product mix that we've got now.
For the industry.
Look, the logic is, if I'm really honest, yeah, it's about money then. Like, let's think. If I put all my effort into ICE, scaling that by a couple of percent is going to be astronomically different to launching an entire product set in Outer Mongolia.
Which is nice.
And I think competition is brilliant because it keeps us on our toes. It makes me think, oh, what are they doing differently? What could we be doing, et cetera, et cetera. Like anyone.
Do you go to the competitors?
I do try to. I try to go
to... Do you wear a disguise or not?
Not yet, but that's a good idea. I like going to events, though. Like, I think we can learn loads. So I will plug an event that I went to just before COVID, OMR. Don't know if any of you have been there, but Online Marketing Rockstars it stands for, and it was amazing. It's got nothing to do with gaming, but you could see what you can do with a B2B event at scale that still delivers a consumer experience. It was incredible, and I highly recommend it if they're able to run it this year. I think it's in May, it's scheduled for. Brilliant event in Hamburg.
As you obviously you work for Clarion,
yeah,
and are probably therefore making some pretty serious money. You would want a top-end disguise. Now, Fintan, little known fact, has luxuriant hair. He would probably sell you some of that if you wanted to make yourself a nice moustache
for your disguise. You know, is it King Charles. Is it King Charles where they have the, I could take some of the hair and put it and make a slight wig, but also like a long sideburns out of them as well.
Pretty sure you can make a hair shirt out of Fintan's hair. Probably some hair trousers. Although you'd have to be a very dedicated Catholic to go for the full hair outfit, the hair onesie. Maybe you are a dedicated Catholic, Alex. I don't know.
Oh, funnily enough.
Just throwing it out there. And Fintan, little sideline for you.
Thanks, mate. I'll note it.
Just thinking of you. I'm thinking of the industry. Nah, I'm just taking the piss. So anyway, Alex, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
No, appreciate it. Really good to speak.
And I know you've done quite a few other podcast appearances. I just didn't want to do a fluff appearance, so I had to bring that up about wearing a disguise our hard hitting edge, our diamond edge.
That, and if I'm really honest, that was the question I was dreading you'd ask me: is what disguise would I wear?
It's very fair, very fair. I would probably wear lederhosen, because that way everybody's looking at your outfit, nobody's looking at your face. But Fintan and I would, thank you. And, we'll see you. Hang on, Fintan, are you going to ICE?
I am.
Well, we'll definitely see you at ICE then, you know. Oh, can we have a gambling file stand? Can we have it where Novomatic would have been? Can we have it the same size as the Novomatic booth?
If you want a gambling file stand, I'm sure we can make that happen. You should build, you guys aren't, but actually, no, Fintan can afford this. Another event I ran, we built an entire like podcast booth out of a camper van. And so you could have catering and all sorts and invite your guests into it. It would look amazing. I'll give you the space for free, everything else.
We could do falafels, Fintan.
We could. Ooh,
but we could do falafels made out of animal. I mean, you could call them burgers, but...
Well, you could maybe use the bears that are being used for the enzyme.
Well, now you're talking. That's a byproduct, so I mean, it's going to be cheaper to buy as well. I think we might have a business here. Alex, thank you.
No worries. Been a pleasure.
And after our first guest, we move quite naturally on to our second guest. We are joined by Sean Chafin, who is a freelance writer and editor of uspoker.com and pokerscout.com, and contributing editor of Casino Player magazine. Sean has also contributed to Casino International magazine, which is where I first met him. Welcome, Sean.
Great to be here with you guys. Nice to meet you, John and Fintan. It'd be nice.
It's our pleasure, I can assure you. So Sean contacted me. He just pitched ideas to me out of the blue, probably 10, 12 years ago, something like that. And luckily we were able to find a tiny amount of budget to pay for his articles. But Sean, you're very knowledgeable on poker. I mean, that's your field of expertise, yeah?
Well, yeah, I write a lot about poker and just gambling in general, casinos. Do some stuff outside of poker, but yeah, I do a lot within the world of poker. I kind of grew up playing the game with my dad and kept at it, so probably write more about it than I play right now, unfortunately.
Well, that's probably not ideal. Or maybe it is. I mean, because you get paid for writing about it, you might or might not get paid for playing it.
That is true.
A few things have happened recently that made me think I should email Sean and ask him about this. So, Sean, there's been rumblings about the possibility of casinos in Texas. And I mean, given the size of some of the sort of urban areas of Texas, I mean, there's big, big cities, densely populated big cities. Is this something that's likely to come off, or is this just people talking out of their asses?
Well, I don't think that casinos are coming to Texas anytime soon. People who usually talk about that don't really understand the law. It would probably take a constitutional amendment for that to go forward, and it would take legislators putting that on the ballot.
Why would it need so much effort?
In general, favor casino gambling, as most polls show. Most of the neighboring states that have casinos, like Oklahoma and Louisiana, if you go into the parking lot on any given day, a lot of the license plates will be from Texas. But as far as the state itself, it just doesn't seem likely to happen in the near future. You would need voters to approve a statewide constitutional amendment on the ballot, and our legislators don't show any interest in making that happen. So you do have one kind of obscure tribal casino down on the border, near the border with Mexico, but that's pretty much it. We have horse racing. It's kind of withering on the vine a little bit, though, because there's no slot machine revenue at those casinos to drive purses. So horse owners with the better race horses tend to pick other tracks in neighboring states like Oklahoma and Louisiana because you're playing for bigger purses.
Right. Here's the part I don't get, though, in what you just said. Why would it need, a constitutional amendment, that's like a fairly big deal in legal terms, right? I mean, that's something that takes a while.
It does for sure. At a federal level, even more so. But our country has what we call federalism, where each state is kind of their own.
That's self-determining, aren't they?
Acts as their own self-determining jurisdiction. So having something like that be approved would need to go through the constitutional amendment stage. It's a little more it's a little easier than a federal constitutional amendment, but it would still need that voter approval. You have to do similar measures in other states as well, depending on their system and what the issue is. There's a lot of differences in each state here in the U.S., and this gaming law can be a part of that in some states, especially so in Texas.
But if there was the desire to do that, are you saying that it's just not the public desire to push that through when you say a ballot, are you talking about a public vote?
Yeah, you would need the state legislators in agreement with the governor would have to have a put that on the ballot for a public vote. Yeah, public vote, a ballot initiative, you might call it. And then it would go to voters in November. There just doesn't seem to be the political will in Texas for that at the moment. And it may be passed by voters, but voters, I guess they have other things on their mind, bigger issues right now. And that doesn't seem to be among them. One thing about Texas compared to like Oklahoma too, or even Louisiana or New Mexico, some of these neighboring states, is that in Texas, there's not a huge number of Indian reservations, Native American reservations. You see quite a few of those in New Mexico where they have gaming facilities or casinos. You see those in Oklahoma a lot, and even there's a big one in South Louisiana called the Coushatta. But Texas has very few reservations to even go that route when it comes to casinos. Like I said, there's one very small casino on the Texas border that is a tribal casino, and it's pretty much the only casino in the entire state. That doesn't mean Texas hasn't had casinos, because Texas has a very unique history of underground casinos. If you're a poker fan and know a little bit about the history of the World Series of Poker, Benny Binion founded the World Series of Poker at the Horseshoe in Las Vegas. Before that, he ran underground casinos all over Dallas-Fort Worth area. And in the 1950s even through the end of the 1950s, he and another guy named Herbert Noble were competitors, and their henchmen would have like open warfare in the middle of the streets of Dallas, sometimes shootouts. There's a really good book called I'll Do My Own Damn Killing about the Dallas-Fort Worth underground casino wars between Benny and Herbert Noble.
That's a great name for a book.
Yeah, Benny Binion's man even tried to shoot Herbert Noble through his hospital room window. And Herbert Noble was a pilot and had a plan at one time to fly over Binion's casino in Nevada and drop dynamite on it. So it's really, it's a real, there is a real history of casinos in Texas, just not above board. And then there's another interesting Texas history footnote about Galveston. I don't know if you've ever heard of that city, but Galveston is basically the oldest, if not the oldest, but one of the oldest cities in the entire state. It's located down on the Gulf of Mexico. It was actually founded by the pirate Jean Lafitte from France. But eventually, it also had underground casinos through the 1930s up until the 1950s by a pair of brothers, the Maceo brothers or Maceo brothers. I'm not sure how you say it, but they ran underground casinos all along Galveston. They had piers out into the water. There was one called the Balinese Room, like Bali, however you say it.
Yep.
And it's extended out onto the water, onto the Gulf of Mexico. And there's a rumor or legend that it had casino equipment that would fold into the walls. If the police were coming, the band would play "The Eyes of Texas Are Upon You," and that would be the signal to hide the casino equipment before the law got in and closed it down. So there's a big, there's a real interesting history of casino gambling in Texas, just no legal ones. I'll give you one more third historical note. There was in Arlington, which is a city located between Fort Worth and Dallas. Arlington is where the Cowboys play now, the Dallas Cowboys. But anyway, there was a seminary there. There is a seminary, I should say, there. But before that, up from the same kind of time period, 30s to the 50s, it was called the Top of the Hill Casino. It was an underground room, and it actually had movie stars that would fly in. And it was like a really high-toned place to go, you know, had gourmet meals, and it had a big gate out front and guards, but it was set over the top of a mountain. I shouldn't say a mountain. There's no mountains in Dallas-Fort Worth, but like on the top of a high hill so you could see if the police were coming from miles away. And it eventually got bought by a preacher who had been trying to get that place closed down forever. He finally did in the 50s, and when it closed down, he bought it, and it's now a Bible church for potential pastors.
Well, all I know about Galveston was taught to me by Glenn Campbell.
Oh, the song Galveston? Yeah, Galveston's a really neat place to go. Lots of history, including casinos.
But I think maybe some of the reticence from Texas as a state to reintroducing sort of gambling comes from the gunfights in the streets that they had the last time they had it there.
Maybe so. I kind of doubt that. Texans are pretty used to gambling. The Choctaw Casino in Oklahoma is literally about an hour and a half from Dallas. It's a pretty short trip depending where you live. So lots of Texans go there. They go to the Windstar, which is also in Oklahoma, and a really short trip.
I've met loads of Texans in Vegas, and
lots of them go to Vegas. Lots of them go to Louisiana. If you live in the Houston area, you can head east to Lake Charles, Louisiana, go to casinos.
Obviously a desire there, so that's the part I don't quite get. Is it getting the political will to get this on the ballot that's the issue?
I would say yes, and I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon.
Well, you know what drives political will is usually money.
Yeah, you occasionally see if there is an effort, you'll see an anti Texas casino effort, and sometimes those are funded from corporations in Oklahoma and Louisiana who have their own casinos there.
So, do you know what I mean? So maybe it's not that far away.
I would say at least 10 years, but that's my prediction. I just kind of know how it goes there. There's just not a political will. And I'm not saying it wouldn't be popular. It would be huge. It'd be probably one of the biggest states in the U.S. as far as casino gambling. I'm sure Caesars would love to have a World Series of Poker event in Texas.
Gotcha.
But I just don't see I don't see it in the near future. It would take a lot.
What's the status of like online betting and sports betting? Is any of that legal?
In Texas, no. That doesn't mean people don't do it illegally. But as far as mobile gaming of any kind, no. Not even mobile horse track betting is legal here. In most states you can that have legal horse betting, you can at least make some wagers on your phone or on your computer or whatever. You can't do that here. Not legally anyway. All this has to do with legally.
But I mean, Texas is like as most states in the U.S. are. But I mean, it's a sports mad state.
Yeah, sure, especially for American football.
I'm a little surprised that is sports betting really? I mean, is that not even feasible?
It's not legal as of now. There have been some minor efforts, but I don't see that anytime soon either.
I mean, with so many other states it's swept through the U.S. I mean, so many states have legalized it now.
Right. There's 31 states. Well, I should say 31 jurisdictions. 29 states, but then also Washington, D.C., and also Puerto Rico, a U.S. territory, just legalized sports betting as well. But in Texas, there doesn't seem to be the political will at the moment. I could see that becoming legal more so than casinos. If you look at a state like Tennessee, which is pretty similar to Texas as far as political views, they have actually legalized sports betting in Tennessee, and they don't even have casinos. It's all mobile. It's all online game, online sports betting, no online casino or anything like that. But I could see that happening at some point maybe, but I still don't think it's very close.
And yeah, the other thing that I wanted to talk to you about is about the – because here's the weird thing. Here's the kind of dichotomy, isn't there, in Texas, because, as you said, there's like a casino down on the border. There's racetracks. There's, you know, there's stuff going on. It's not that it's a state that's anti-gambling. But no. the really interesting part for me is – And I think things are shifting with this now, is poker clubs. Am I right in saying poker clubs, not poker rooms? They are like kind of
clubs,
pitched as private members.
I don't care, whatever you want to call it is fine with me, but they're not casinos. And when you mention the casino down on the border, you got to understand that's a pretty far distance from almost every Texan. It's not like it's close to a metropolitan area too much, but yeah, these poker rooms go back in Texas for a long time. You know, Doyle Brunson used to travel the Southwest and the South looking for games, and these guys like Amarillo Slim and Doyle Brunson were buying games all over Texas. But they've never been officially legal. Even in the 2000s when, you know, the World Poker Tour and the World Series of Poker took off along with televised poker, you could find underground rooms all over the state, but they would get closed down, you know, as the vice squads kind of cracked down. But I would say, you know, in the last 5 years, these poker clubs, poker rooms, whatever you want to call them, have started to grow. They try to function as if they were a country club, okay, where you pay dues, you pay, you rent your seat, and the house doesn't take what we would call a traditional rake, where you take a percentage of each hand or you take a tournament fee. And that's kind of how they've gotten around the law as of now.
Okay.
You even have some big names like Doug Polk and Mike Mattisau have recently, bought into some of these clubs, bought a share of the clubs.
But it's clear as mud, though. Do you know what I mean? Like the law just seems really like, I don't know.
Maybe I've got the law here in front of me if you want to know more about that.
Well, I just... So you've got these like private clubs, right?
Right.
But I was reading something quite recently, and I swear I can't find it again now. But I was reading something fairly recently that was suggesting that the clubs were going to start struggling because of possible changes in the law.
Well, you haven't seen a lot of crackdowns on these for the last 5 years, except kind of in the North Texas area, in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. You haven't seen as many of these clubs. You've seen a lot of them in San Antonio, Austin, Houston, and kind of the South Texas area, but not so much in Dallas. But in the last, you know, couple years, you've seen a few of them sprout up in Dallas and even seek permits from the city of Dallas to occupy these spaces. Now, within the last month or so, the city of Dallas has revoked some of those permits. So you're starting to see a little bit of pushback, at least in the North Texas area. Now, if you take on these clubs, let's say you open a club, John, okay? John's Poker Club in
it's a good name.
Plano, Texas, okay? Right in the heart of Dallas or the Dallas area. You take on a significant risk because they're kind of in a gray area as of now. At any second, John's club could be in legal trouble because the attorney general of the state may say, all these clubs have 90 days to close their doors. They're not operating within state law. So if you take on this idea that you're going to open a club, you kind of have to be ready legally that you could be shut down at any time. And that seems to be what's happening a little bit in Dallas, but more with local authorities.
It's this weird thing where you've got these clubs operating in what is best described as a gray area.
Right.
But they're advertising,
is right, best described. Because if you look at the law, and I don't know if you know the Gambling and the Law blog or the gambling expert lawyer, I. Nelson Rose, he's written quite a bit about this. And he thinks they're in very, very legal limbo in how they operate.
Yeah.
Because even though they say they're not taking a rake, they're taking some financial gain for operating a place that allows gambling in some form.
Yep.
So even though the attorney general hasn't ruled them illegal or cracked down on them, you're still seeing kind of a gray area, like you said, or beyond a gray area, according to Professor Rose.
It was his piece that that I read that prompted me to email you. I've just found it. And it's it's from his Gambling and the Law thing, but it was reproduced on Casino Compendium website. But it's all about Texas poker clubs. What's the future for these clubs? I mean, is the political wind? Because I mean, as we discussed before we started recording, Texas is a big ass state, and what happens in the north doesn't necessarily happen in the. I mean, it's essentially got four different countries within it anyway. But are we talking about statewide? Are they going to struggle? What do you think is going to happen? What's the future for these little anomalies?
Well, you know, I was talking about this with a friend of mine from Houston, actually. And, you know, what's interesting is you didn't see a lot of pushback on these when they were kind of quiet. They just kind of blended into the background a little bit, didn't, you know, advertise too much. But you're starting to see more advertising about big guarantees and, you know, commercials on sports radio stations and things like that. And you start to wonder, like, are they pushing it too much, some of these clubs, where at some point the attorney general or like county district attorneys are going to look at these and say they're kind of pushing themselves out there, is what I should say. They're making it. Are they making too much of a noise where some law enforcement entity is going to say we need to put a stop to this? Let's look at the law again. I don't know. I just know that if you look at the law, A lot of experts don't believe they're falling within the law. Whether the state decides they want to crack down or not, I don't know. I mean, most of them seem to be pretty safe, secure places. State legislators may decide we're going to legalize these clubs, but I don't think there's been any effort at that either. So, like you said, they're just kind of in this legal limbo. They're just like in this limbo where you don't really know what's going to happen. You just kind of have to wait and see. And if you get away with operating your club, you do. And if you get closed down, you get closed down.
Problem is, though,
there haven't been a lot of closures except for recently in Dallas.
But with this operating in a gray area, it kind of, I'm not sure that it helps legitimize gambling. Do you know what I mean? I'm not sure that it helps with the sort of reputation and the potential for, you know, casinos, et cetera, in the future, because, like, you know, if somebody sees that a poker club has been shut down, the immediate, I mean, even before you read the article, if you read the article, in your head, it's all negative connotation. But it's been shut down, must have been doing something bad.
Right.
You know, so I think there's the potential for this to cause sort of, you know, people just making a quick buck, or probably more likely because, you know, nobody makes a lot of money off poker, you know, fulfilling an actual need in the market. I mean, just the existence of these clubs. And Rose estimates there is between 30 and 100 clubs, which is not a small number. Then that suggests to me that there is definitely a market waiting to happen. And maybe some casino groups need to start working together and lobbying, because, you know, the big cities in Texas are massive cities. Just for the record, John's Poker Room would be in Odessa.
Do you know where Odessa is?
Don't care where Odessa is. That's where it'd be.
It's the Friday Night Lights reference. Is that what it is?
It's way west, isn't it?
Right. It's way out in West Texas. Not a whole lot of people out there. Lots of empty space.
Yeah, I just want the Permian Panther shirt. That's all I want, really.
Oh, you're talking about Friday Night. Okay, Friday Night Lights. That's a fictional account of that. That was a real team up.
Yeah, I'm talking about the book.
In Odessa. Yeah, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah.
I read the book before the series. Well, I've read the book before the series or the film were made, I think. Wow. And it's a tremendous book.
Yeah, it is a good book. But yeah, there's definitely a thirst for poker and gambling in general, but I still don't think there's a will to make it happen. I will say that I could see the state legalizing poker clubs like this before they would legalize casinos.
Is the church influential in Texas? I mean, could that be a factor?
I would say it could be. It's more of a conservative state for sure. But I know a lot of churchgoers that definitely go to the casinos in Oklahoma and Louisiana for sure. I think that's less of a factor maybe now so than it may have been 20 years ago.
But the church as an organization generally acts as though it has to be seen to be opposing things that people enjoy.
Well, I wouldn't say everything like that, but you know, there's some religious groups that probably are opposed, and I think there's some that probably have less of a problem with it. It just kind of depends on you. But in general, I could maybe see these clubs being legalized in some form, but I don't see casinos anytime soon. There is kind of a poker club. What should I say? There is kind of a poker club trend in some other states as well. Texas isn't the only state with these clubs. You also see them, I think, in Oregon and Washington. But those are legit and, you know, above board. They're fully legal. Texas is kind of in this spot where you have a bunch of them, but maybe they're not fully legal. So maybe something like that could change down the line. Sorry, my phone. But I don't know. I don't really know where they head right now. I think people are just kind of doing the wait and see on these clubs.
I think my hunch is because, I mean, Texas would, as you say, I mean, it would almost certainly be one of the biggest states in terms of casino gaming. should it become legal, and the sportsbook aspect of that is just blows the mind. Would not surprise me if the money started heading down there.
Every single border state around Texas has casinos: Louisiana, Arkansas, Oklahoma, and New Mexico.
But the positioning of those casinos as well, I know some of those are close to the border, aren't they?
Most of them are, not maybe so much as in New Mexico. New Mexico is a pretty desolate state for the most part, very low population. There's not as many big cities along the border, but the state does have casinos too. So every state around Texas has casinos, but Texas does not. And you may see that. Maybe some of the reason it doesn't ever happen is because legislators can say, well, if you want to gamble, it's not a far trip. I don't know.
But that's all tax revenue that's going into the state.
That's definitely true.
And that is the kind of thing that can change a legislator's mind. If somebody put those figures together and said, look, we're losing, or rather we're not getting this amount of tax every year, that would change minds really fast.
You would think, but not necessarily. What's funny is you'll see, as you go up to Oklahoma, you know, you get cities like Gainesville and Whitesboro. You'll actually see some Texans from some of those states who deal cards at the Oklahoma casino. It may be a 20-minute trip to work for them, and they deal in Oklahoma, drive back and live in Texas.
Can I ask you a question, Sean? I mean, I know I've been asking you a lot of questions, but before you were a freelance writer, and I just wanted to talk about this because I find it interesting personally. You were a teacher before you were a writer, is that right?
Right. I have a background in newspapers and magazines, and I taught journalism and newspaper at a small high school around Dallas. And yearbook, we do yearbook too here.
Okay. Because I remember when we first started talking, I'm pretty sure you were still teaching. Right. And then you took the plunge to go freelance. Has that worked out pretty well?
It's been fantastic, definitely.
You sound happy.
Yeah, I love it. I like working for myself. I'm kind of an entrepreneurial guy. I like being my own boss. I don't like meetings, and I don't like demos.
Fenton is the king of meetings.
Oh, yeah. We don't have any meetings here in my office. New Mexico.
Fenton's got a mug, and on the side of the mug it says, I fucking love meetings.
I've actually got a mug that says, I heart spreadsheets. That's my go-to mug in the office.
But that's also true, right?
It is very true. Very true.
But you know what? Like you say, the entrepreneurial thing, Fenton recently sold his business, which is something that we hark back to a lot on this. He's sold his business, and he's now like, he's probably sitting in a bath of truffles recording this.
That must be nice.
Is it comfortable, Fenton? Is it a little chilly?
It's it was hard getting all the truffles. They're quite expensive, but we made it work. We made it work.
Well, I'm sure pre-sale that would have been difficult, but now easy peasy. And everybody knows the more money you have, the less stuff you have to pay for.
Mm.
Which has got to be the most annoying thing in the world, frankly.
That is true.
But I mean, I wouldn't know. Clearly you have to pay for everything.
You guys ever been to Texas?
I've never been to Texas. Fenton?
No.
I've never had the pleasure. Never had the pleasure.
Well, but Odessa is genuinely somewhere I would love to visit.
It's a little different than, it's way out in West Texas. It's desolate, wide open spaces.
Oh, flat. I love that shit.
But if you guys ever get a chance, I think you'd really like it. Lots of nice people, lots of interesting places to go, lots of history. It's a neat place. I keep saying I'm living there now. I actually moved to New Mexico in August. But yeah, I love Texas. Lots of family there. And give back a lot.
Well, I mean, you are a Texan, aren't you?
For sure. Maybe some of your English listeners may not understand me with this Texas drawl, but hopefully they'll be able to understand.
Sean, we have a very international group of listeners.
Oh, fantastic.
But I appreciate that you just brought that up because that gives me the opportunity to talk about where our listeners are. We've got the bulk of them are North America. America and the UK. We've got a bunch in Ireland and four in Portugal. Few in France, few in Germany, Belgium, the Netherlands, two in Poland, two in Norway, which has always been a disappointment, only three in Russia, one in India, one in Saudi Arabia. They've come up a couple of times today. A couple in Indonesia, few in Australia, five in New Zealand. But South America, we're really lacking. Two in Peru and two in Colombia. I mean, I think we can develop those markets, Fintan. Your thoughts?
I'll start learning Spanish and let's get after it.
I think that's the way forward. And also video. I think they'd appreciate a bit of video.
Yeah, we can do video. We
also have the technology. None in Greenland or Iceland.
Really?
Yeah, none. Which is deeply disappointing. But yeah.
Any in Texas?
Well, we got 15 in Mexico. But the States doesn't break down. It doesn't break down as a... it does break down. Sorry. California, Nevada, Arizona. Yep, bunch in Texas.
Well, that's good.
Virginia and Ohio are our best states, though.
Virginia, I don't think even has casinos.
No, but they love this podcast.
Well, that's good.
There's five in Michigan. That's probably all my brother. But yes, it's really interesting when you see the breakdown of all the stats. It's interesting to me. I probably just bored the shit out of you two with it. Sean, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your knowledge on all things Texas gambling. Just talk about your mixed messages from a state. Do you know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you've got a casino. No, you can't have any more. Yeah, you can play poker. Yeah, but you can't have slots at a racetrack. You know, it's just like it's going to come. But like you say, maybe it'll take a while.
Maybe for sure, Texas is a very independent-minded people. Texans are very independent-minded people and don't always follow the trend of everybody else. They have a real independent streak. So
you don't mess with Texas.
That's what you don't do. That's for sure.
Sean, thank you for joining us today. Much appreciated. We hope you enjoyed this edition of the Gambling Files podcast. If you enjoyed it, please like the Gambling Files podcast on LinkedIn, follow us on Twitter, share. That's the most important thing because this is growing wonderfully by word of mouth and recommendation. If you have any suggestions for guests or if you think maybe you'd like to be on, then please contact us. Maybe you've got a story to tell. Until the next time.